So we're continuing from yesterday. There are five verses grouped together which state 40 transcendental qualities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Yesterday we read some, and today we start with Gyanam. So we won't read the whole translation, but just those we're covering today. In him reside knowledge, absence of sense enjoyment, leadership, chivalry, influence, the power to make everything possible, the discharge of proper duty, complete independence, dexterity, fullness of all beauty, serenity, kind-heartedness. And taking up from the purport, continuing by Srila Prabhupada, these are all descriptions of Lord Krishna. The Lord never deviates from his word of honor. When he gives assurance for protection, the promise is executed in all circumstances. It is the duty of the pure devotee to be fixed in the discharge of the duty entrusted to him by the Lord or the Lord's bona fide representative, the spiritual master. The rest is carried on by the Lord without a break. The responsibility of the Lord is also unique. The Lord has no responsibility because all his work is done by his different appointed energies. But still he accepts voluntary responsibilities in displaying different roles in his transcendental pastimes. As a boy, he was playing the part of a cowboy. As the son of Nanda Maharaj, he discharged responsibility perfectly. Similarly, when he was playing the part of a Kshatriya, as the son of Maharaj Vasudev, he displayed all the skill of a martially spirited Kshatriya. In almost all cases, the Kshatriya king has to secure a wife by fighting or kidnapping. This sort of behavior for a Kshatriya is praiseworthy in the sense that a Kshatriya must show his power of chivalry to his would-be wife so that the daughter of a Kshatriya can see the valor of her would-be husband. Even the personality of Godhead Sri Rama displayed such a spirit of chivalry during his marriage. He broke the strongest bow called Haradhanur and achieved the hand of Sita Devi, the mother of all opulence. The Kshatriya spirit is displayed during marriage festivals, and there is nothing wrong in such fighting. Lord Sri Krishna discharged such responsibility fully because although he had more than 16,000 wives, in each and every case he fought like a chivalrous Kshatriya and thus secured a wife. To fight 16,000 times to secure 16,000 wives is certainly possible only for the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Similarly, he displayed full responsibility in every action of his different transcendental pastimes. Now, these are actually qualities that were included in yesterday's verse, responsibility and Prabhupada also discusses that Krishna is true to his word. So whatever Krishna does, he does to an infinite degree. And therefore you cannot measure these qualities, but we try to appreciate them and try to understand them. When in the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna, he was convinced that Krishna was the supreme truth, the Param Brahman. They are interested in meditating on Brahman, but the personality of Godhead, he is Param Brahman. Brahmano hi pratishtaha. The impersonal Brahman resides in me, is subordinate to me, Krishna says. So Arjuna accepted Krishna as the Param Brahma, and he said, It is not that only I accept you, that I am partial, but this conclusion is also accepted by great sages like Narada, Devala, Asita. This conclusion is taken up by all the Mahajans, or great authorities. But for others' benefit, Arjuna asked Krishna to describe some of his opulences as they appear in the material world. And before he did so, Krishna said, I will tell you some of the manifestations of the opulences of God, but it is not possible to fully describe them, but I will give you some sampling. So, this is a fact, although we may discuss 40 qualities of God, and in the Nectar of Devotion, there are 64 qualities of Krishna described there very nicely. It is not an attempt to conclude as if we can now understand everything about Krishna, but it is an attempt to glorify the Lord, and it is for the benefit of the devotees and the conditioned souls to hear about the qualities of Krishna, so we become attracted to Krishna and diverted from being attracted to the so-called qualities of this world which we are attached to. Therefore, this kind of glorification goes on, and it is due to Krishna. Whatever Krishna did here in his incarnation, he excelled what anybody could do. He appeared as a historical person, manusyanam sahas avajanati mam mudha manusim tanam asritam param bhavam ajananto mama bhuta maheshparam. The foolish people, they think that I am a human being because I appear in the human society, but they do not know my transcendental nature and supreme dominion over all that be. So Krishna appeared 5,000 years ago in Mathura, but the activities that he performed, nobody can match them. This is Godhead. Therefore, he's called Bhagavan. He possesses opulences to an infinite degree. Aishvaryasya, Samagrasya, Biryasya, Yasya-Sasriya, Jnana-Vairagya. The opulences of... this was described by the father of Vyasadeva, Parasara Muni. He gave a definition of God, the Supreme Person, the Supreme Being, that he must be all opulent. He must have all the attractive features of a person in this world, but he must have them to an infinite degree. So he listed six. Wealth. If a person has wealth in this world, that makes him attractive. In Kali Yuga, it doesn't matter very much how you get the wealth, unfortunately. But wealth itself, then you are a big man. Practically, you can come out and say you stole the wealth. But if you have the wealth, then you are attractive. But there are other opulences aside from that, or grouped with that. Of course, if you have more than one opulence, then you're more attractive. So if you have a bodily beauty, then that's attractive. A beautiful man, a beautiful woman. Then if you have knowledge, even if you don't have beauty, you'll be very attractive to people by your knowledge, as you display your knowledge. Then power, strength. Everyone will be attracted to the strong person in this world. He'll take shelter there, and he will glorify that person. And fame is an opulence. If you're very famous, that practically equals being attractive. Wherever you go, thousands of people will gather and discuss your activities on the television and in newspapers. Whatever you do, everyone will be wanting to know about it. These are opulences. And then, having all so many opulences, if a person, if furthermore, has the opulence of renunciation, that means he's not even attached, that he may be wealthy, he may have knowledge, but he doesn't depend on these things. He is renounced. Like in religious history, the renunciation of Jesus Christ or Buddha or so many sages in India is very attractive because they were able to practice austerity and give up the things that everyone else is attached to. They became attractive, highly attractive, for their renunciation. So, according to Parasara Muni, you take all these opulences and you find them in one person. This is unusual. That he's very, very powerful and strong, and yet he's beautiful, and yet he has knowledge, and he has wealth, fame, all of this, and he's renounced. We hardly find. Maybe someone has a little bit of one or the other. But find a person that has all the qualities to the infinite degree. That means there is no challenge. He's not the most powerful man for this 2 or 3 years, and then he's diminished, kicked out. But he is always powerful. His beauty doesn't grow old. His fame doesn't diminish. That is God. That is the meaning of the word Bhagavan. So sometimes Swamis and Yogis, they take this name Bhagavan, but it is not possible that they are Bhagavan. They cannot escape a beating, or they are begging for money. Where is their strength? Where is their opulence? And who has heard of these Bhagavans as they come and go? So Bhagavan means Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Sri Bhagavan Uvacha, in the Bhagavad Gita, whenever Krishna speaks, it is stated, Sri Bhagavan Uvacha is not an ordinary person. Therefore, it is so improper for Arjuna not to obey when Sri Bhagavan Uvacha. And we should also accept the words of Bhagavan Sri Krishna. Krishna's tu Bhagavan Swayam. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, the list of incarnations is given, that in the first millennium, the Lord will appear in the form, each form is described. He appears as here, Narsingadev, as Vamana incarnation, as Rama. One after another, they're described. Krishna is also described, and Balaram, and then after them, the prediction is made there, thousands of years before his appearance, of Lord Buddha, what town he would be born in and who his parents would be. And then in the future, which is yet to come, the incarnation of Kalki is described. So then after the whole list is given, including Krishna and Balaram, Vyasadeva says, all these incarnations, they are parts, or they are expansions from the original. But that one that we mentioned along the way, Krishna, Krishna's tu Bhagavan Swayam. Krishna is the source of all the other incarnations. He is actually Bhagavan. So this is authoritative evidence that Krishna, although we may accept that that Krishna is the, sometimes they say he's the eighth incarnation of Vishnu. So that's all right, because he did appear on schedule. He's responsible. He comes on schedule once in a day of Brahma. But then he's Krishna's too Bhagavan Swayam. He's actually the source of Vishnu also. So therefore, when he displays activities, even of a human sort, they're without limit. And we can only appreciate a small fraction of them. So Krishna is described here as true to his word of honor. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna makes very important promises for all the conditioned souls. Sarva dharmam parityajna mam ekam saranam braja aham tvam sarva papebhyo moksha shami masucha. Surrender to me, Krishna says, and then I will free you from the reactions to your sins. Don't be afraid. This is the promise of Krishna. And then he promises, Kauntaya pratijanihi name bhakta pranishati. Actually, he tells Arjuna, Arjuna, you make the promise, and I will stand behind it, that my devotee will never perish. I take him to the other side of death. To one who thinks of me, he'll never be lost to me, I'll never be lost to him. At the end, he will reach the supreme abode. Krishna promises, and he keeps that promise. Then we may ask, why does he say, Kauntaya pratijanihi name bhakta pranishati? Why does he say, Arjuna, you make a promise, tell them that the devotee of Krishna will never be vanquished? That is because the devotee's promise will also be kept by Krishna. In the activities of Krishna in the Mahabharata, when Krishna was on the side of Arjuna, Yudhisthira, he sometimes engaged in activities that appear duplicitous. People, they don't understand, they think Krishna is an unreliable person. But it was warfare, and sometimes Krishna was dealing in clever ways on the battlefield. Just like in order to discourage Dronacharya, who was so powerful on the other side, Krishna said, if he can hear that his son is dead, Aswatthama, that will discourage him in the fighting. So he told Yudhisthira, King Yudhisthira, Aswatthama is not dead, but you go before Dronacharya and tell him Aswatthama is dead, and then we will gain in the battle. So Yudhisthira, he's known as Dhammaraj because he's the son of Yamaraj by Kunti. So he's religion personified, truth personified. And he said to Krishna, I have my reputation of never telling a lie. I cannot do this. So as a result of that, his pure standing as a devotee of Krishna was a little diminished. Because whatever Krishna wants, one should not take shelter in the relative morality. Krishna is absolute morality. That means he is good. Sometimes our relative morality, like family and nation, fails. They're not the highest thing. So sometimes an individual citizen, he has to act on his conscience. In America, they have the example of Thoreau, who practiced on one occasion civil disobedience, and then Gandhi displayed this. So although such teachers, all teachers, will tell us to follow these traditional systems of truth and honor and in family and in all dealings, ethical dealings, there are sometimes higher principles, and the highest principle is satisfying God or Krishna. Devarshi bhutapta nirnam pitranam nakinkaro nayam nare nirajam. This verse describes different persons and institutions to whom we're obliged. Devarshi means the demigods. Bhutapta means all living entities. Rishis. So, when a person is born into this world, he's obliged to his mother and father because they gave him his birth. He's obliged to the rishis because they've given knowledge. He's not born into a world of primitive ignorance. He can take knowledge from the books. And he has an obligation to the demigods who are supplying the air and the light. And he's obliged to the state as he lives in law and order with all civic arrangement. And if a human being doesn't return these debts, then he is condemned in the next life. It will not be auspicious if he simply takes without contributing. But however, Devarshi Bhutapta Nirnam Pitranam Kinkaro Nayam Rene Chirajan Sarvatmana Yak Sharanam Sharanyam Kato Mukundam. If one serves Krishna, then all his obligations are fulfilled. This is the conclusion. Demigod's obligation, the obligation to parents, all other obligations are fulfilled if one surrenders to Krishna. He doesn't have to discharge them separately. And if someone says, oh, you're neglecting a duty here, that's a misunderstanding. Just like in wartime, the soldier, he goes to fight for the country. So someone may say, oh, this man, he's neglecting his family. Or he's not appearing in his hometown church. Or he's not going to court. He's not doing his other work. But he's doing the supreme sacrifice for the country. So he may be suspended. Rather, he'll be honored, even though he was not at home. So similarly, actually all the demigods are pleased, and the devas, the rishis are pleased. And whether they're pleased or not, the family is benefited, and the country is benefited, in which such a person is performing Krishna consciousness. However, when Krishna asked Yudhisthira to lie, he said, I can't lie. So he got some reaction. In the Mahabharata, it is described that Yudhisthira, because of his great saintly qualities, his chariot would not even touch the ground as it rode. It would rise above the ground. But after that remark to Krishna, then his chariot rode on the ground. But Krishna also then had the reputation that he may say something, it may be true, and it may not be true. So he said, Kauntiya Pratijanahi, you tell everyone. Because Krishna, he is certainly true. He may be a little untrue in some dealing like that. Aswatthama is dead. Actually, even that, technically, he was preserving some truth. Yudhisthira finally agreed. He only hesitated. He did not disobey Krishna. So then he said, you don't have to tell a lie if you don't like to tell a lie. Just shout out very loudly, Aswatthama, and then say very softly, the elephant, and then say loudly, is dead. So in this way, he was diplomatic. But so he may do something like that to help his devotee. But as far as the promise to the devotee, that he will never break, even if he has to break some other honor. So Krishna was tested in that also, on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. He was fighting with the Pandavas, and on the other side was another very great devotee, one of the 12 Mahajans, Bhishma Dev. Bhishma was obliged to fight on the side of Dhritarashtra because he was living at his expense, and he was a Kshatriya of the Kurus. So when the civil war split up, he was on that side. This is the tragedy of civil war, that sometimes brothers are on either opposite sides. So although Bhishma was a great devotee of Krishna, he was on the other side. So as the fighting was going on, he was the greatest warrior of all, Bhishma, grandfather Bhishma. So Duryodhana, he wanted to prod Bhishma to fight even more. And he expressed a doubt. He said, Bhishma, I think because Krishna and the brothers are on the other side and you're so affectionate to them, you're not fighting at your full capacity. So this remark, slighting the Kshatriya prowess of Bhishma, was an insult to Bhishma. He said, this is not true. Don't say like this. In fact, I guarantee you then, tomorrow, he said, I will kill all the Pandavas. I have five special arrows. And with these arrows, I will kill the Pandavas. So Duryodhana was very pleased to hear the promise of Bhishma, and he took those arrows for safekeeping to his camp and waited the next day. So the way they fought, these great Kshatriyas, as Prabhupada says, they were just displaying their power, and even if they fought at a marriage, it was not regarded as a bad thing. So they would fight all during the day, and then at night, they would act as friends. This was their chivalry. They would dine together with the enemy. The fighting was stopped at a certain time at night. And they would talk, and they would dine, and then the next day they would fight to the death again. So it was not unusual to have some exchange like that after the day's fighting. Therefore, Krishna, he knew, because he is all knowledge, that Duryodhana is keeping these five arrows to slay the Pandavas tomorrow. So he told Arjuna that he has these arrows. Now you go and to his camp and tell him, remind him that he has an obligation to me from the past. He made a vow that he would return me any boon. Tell him that I would like that boon returned in the form of these five arrows. So Arjuna went on Krishna's behalf. He was received in the camp in a friendly way. And he said, Duryodhana said, Arjuna, you've come. Please welcome. You're welcome to the camp. Whatever you want is yours. In fact, if you ask me, I'll give you anything. Even if you ask me to surrender, we'll surrender. What is your wish? He said, I want those five arrows that you have you're planning to use against the Pandavas. So Duryodhana, because he kept the spirit of the Kshatriya, he immediately turned them over. But then the next day, Bhishma found he had no five arrows, which were guaranteed to kill the Pandavas. He said, it doesn't matter. I don't need those arrows. I am so aroused, I am so angry by your slighting me that I can't fight because they're my friends. That don't worry, I'm going to kill Arjuna. And no one can save Arjuna unless Krishna himself wants to save him. But Krishna has promised that he will not fight in this battle. That was the original promise before the fighting at Kurukshetra. Krishna said that he would not fight. He would be the chariot driver for the Pandavas, but he would not fight personally. That was his promise. Of course, if Krishna fought, then who could oppose him? So they had this solace on the other side. They got Krishna's armies, Arjuna got Krishna, but neither could Krishna fight. So that was guaranteed by Krishna's promise. And here it says that Krishna is true to his word. But Bhishma thought, Krishna has two promises. He says, Kontiya pratijanihi name bhakta punishati. I will always protect my devotee. But he also said he wouldn't fight. So Bhishma said, I'm going to fight in such a way that Krishna will have to break his promise, or I'm going to kill Arjuna. Or in other words, I'm going to kill Arjuna and no one can stop me. And Krishna, he will have to stand by. So it was a fact. Bhishma went forward and he went for the chariot of Arjuna. He overcame Arjuna. He cracked his chariot into pieces, and Arjuna had to get down off the chariot, and he was about to be killed in a minute. So in that minute of decision, Krishna, without any hesitation, was ready to throw aside his so-called promise, which he made before everyone, that I won't fight, in order to protect the devotee. So he jumped off the chariot, he picked up a wheel, a disjointed wheel that was lying on the battlefield, and he held it, and he ran to Bhishma and said, Bhishma, if you make another move to Arjuna, I'm going to kill you right now. So Bhishma, of course, being a great devotee of Krishna, He found this very wonderful, because he liked to fight and to see his worshipable Lord opposing him as a military opponent. We cannot understand this. We would faint at the scene. But Bhishma was such a bold, chivalrous fighter, and he always meditated on Krishna. So to see Krishna in this form, Krishna had blood covering him, and his hair was disheveled. There was dust all over his body. And this feature was very beautiful for Bhishma Dev. Actually, the blood had been drawn by Bhishma's arrows. And Vishwanath Chakravarti, one commentator of Srimad Bhagavatam, has said that the Lord felt these arrows just like a lover will feel kisses. Because it was Bhishma's fighting spirit. So they were face to face in that way, that if you move another inch toward Arjuna, you'll be killed. And Bhishma said, "I surrender." And at that moment, the fighting of the day was finished. And Bhishma got the satisfaction of seeing Krishna break his promise to fulfill his ultimate promise that he will always protect the devotee. So a devotee does not think that Krishna is cheating him in any way. He doesn't always understand the plan of Krishna. But he always knows and he always expects Krishna's mercy. In the United States now, there's one book that is a popular bestseller written by a rabbi. And in this book, he tells his personal experience how his son died of leukemia over a long illness. And the conclusion of his book is that therefore there is no God, although he's supposed to be some religious minister. But also very eager to read this book. That the man is very bitter. How could there be God if my son has died? But the devotee, he never thinks, "Oh, God has made a promise, now he has broken it. I prayed to him for this, he didn't give it." But they always know that whatever, if they surrender to Krishna, and however Krishna deals with them, they accept it as Krishna's mercy. And Krishna is actually seeing for their welfare. Sometimes some suffering may be a purification. It may be a test. It may be actually a form of Krishna protecting us from a greater danger. As Krishna keeps his promise, the devotee also never wavers in his devotion to the Lord. And this is the ideal reciprocation of the Lord and the devotee. Therefore, Krishna says, "To one who always thinks of me, I'm never lost to him, and he is never lost to me." In any situation, he is satisfied serving and remembering Krishna. We should have full faith in the promises Krishna makes in Bhagavad Gita and try to fulfill our promise. Today there is initiation. The devotees are promising, "I will always chant 16 rounds. I will follow the four rules." So Krishna's promise is there that he will take you back to Godhead. But you have to fulfill your promise. We are tiny living beings. We cannot, you may say that, "Well, I can't put the force of Godhead behind my promise." I may say to you, "Tomorrow I'll give you $15. But then, although I promised it, tomorrow I cannot do it." Or I may say, "I'll protect you," but I can't protect you. Therefore, sometimes a politician, he says that, "I will give you this, I will give you that," but actually he cannot do it. Someone says, "I am everybody's friend," but how can he be everybody's friend? He hasn't got that power. God has that power. So then, if we promise God, we're only tiny living beings. How can we fulfill the promise of God? But Krishna will help us in that. If it is to follow the order of the spiritual master, then with that order comes the ability to do it. That is a blessing that we receive. Because also, when we become engaged in devotional service, we experience a higher taste. Aishvara yasyas am. Vishayavani vartante, niraharasi dehina, rasyavaryam praso yasya, param jishvani vartate. You experience a higher taste and then you can be detached. So if we promise, I will not engage in illicit sex, I will not take intoxicants, I will not eat meat, and if you try to chant Hare Krishna and follow the spiritual master's order, you'll get the spiritual power, the tejas, to become detached from these things. Everyone is detached, everyone is attached, but you'll become detached and you'll be able to keep your promise to the spiritual master. But you have to actually engage your senses, engage your mind in this service. And even in a difficult situation, Krishna will protect your vow and Krishna will allow you to call on him and to be true. The devotee is true as the Lord is true. And this is their perfection in union. This is the oneness, not the Mayavadi oneness, but how the devotee and the Lord, they have no separate interests. Krishna wants to serve the devotee, and the devotee wants to serve Krishna, and they're always true. This is pure devotional service. Whether the Lord gives the devotee some material benediction or not, it doesn't matter. Lord Chaitanya prays in the Shikshastakam, Oh my Lord, you may make me broken-hearted by not being present before me, you may handle me roughly in your embrace, but you remain for me, my worshipful Lord, unconditionally. Whatever you do, you are my worshipful Lord. So this is the sublime rasa of Krishna and Bhakta. So are there any questions? Yes.
Becoming very popular with the Deva for many rises to consider the incident and the events in the Puranas and the other messages to be merely imaginary and to discount their true historical value and to interpret them as being symbolic of the ethical and moral principle. Is this a proof justifiable?
Not if we accept this literature as Shastra. If you take it that they are some collection of fairy tales, then you're free to think like that. But if someone, then what is their value? If they're simply collections of imaginary stories, then we cannot accept, just like Krishna, whatever he says, we accept as absolute truth because he's Bhagavan. Therefore, the Mahajans and the Acharyas in disciplic succession, they never say this. It may be fashionable for the unauthorized person to speculate, but those persons who actually guide the destiny of the Shastras, the Puranas, for human society, they never say this. Whether it's Ramanuja or Madhva or Lord Chaitanya or this whole line of the cyclic succession who know the Puranas, they don't think that Vyasadeva was such a trifler that along with his philosophy he made some stories and put them in there in a symbolical way. But he rather says that all these things, they're absolute. They're not material activities, neither are they imaginary activities. Of course, they are things that don't jibe with our ordinary material experience, but there are so many things that we don't experience. So we just reject that. We reject that interpretation. Which is made by persons who are outside the disciplic succession, who don't practice bhakti yoga, and who therefore are actually not fit to touch the Shastra. Therefore, there's an injunction that only the Brahmin should study the Vedas or disseminate the Vedas. There are qualifications to understand and to gain the realization. And if one doesn't practice these, hearing from a spiritual master, then he may come to so many conclusions. So we should not be ourselves bewildered by these speculations about the histories. They take place in different planets, and on this planet, and they are to be taken as actual. Therefore, Mahabharata means the great history of Bharatvarsha. It is actually history. And we accept it in disciplic succession on the authority of the Acharyas, Acharya Sampradaya. We're not obliged to follow the changing fashion. What do you think? Yes?
What are your views about certain experiments that are being conducted presently on parapsychology and certain tests to prove, you know,
well,
something survives the body, like the near-death experience is reported by some professors?
Well, they shed a kind of interesting light on that there is life after death, or there is a realm of consciousness beyond the what is perceived by the gross senses. So, therefore, they are indicating something which is factual, but we can't cite them as absolute evidence. It's like when you go into court, you have to bring very solid evidence for your case, or else if that evidence is defeated, then your case will be defeated if you bring up weak evidence. So we agree with the conclusion that there is life after death, but we can't bring it forward as solid evidence, although we may mention it in a more or less casual way, as a kind of sidelight. I wrote a few articles in the Back to Godhead when I would cite some evidence, and then say, so if people are actually interested in this phenomena, then they would do well to study the Vedic literature, where long before the modern studies of parapsychology, all this was discussed in great detail. And so if people are interested in parapsychology, we can invite them to study the subject matter in Srimad Bhagavatam, where it's described very explicitly. Otherwise, they make so many conclusions. Although they have different conclusions, most of these near-death experiences, at least in the popular books, life after life after life, or was it life after death, they all the people say that they almost died, or they did die, and then they came back, and the experience was very wonderful. So, the actual experience of death for an ordinary man, or where he goes in the next life, is not actually very wonderful. But he has to go through a hellish next life. So these kind of superficial conclusions that the next life is very beautiful and you see a warm light and you see all your friends and everything is nice. So we described in one article, I described about how Ajamil had a near-death experience and he saw that Yamadutas coming. It was very horrible. But then some people wrote me and said, well, our books say that it's very nice. But then I gave the example of very nice, the experience of Bhisma Dev at his passing away, that he saw Krishna. So it may be nice according to your state of mind, but it may also be horrible if your life is sinful and at the end you don't think of Krishna. So they're dabbling, they're getting a little warmer than just staying in the with the gross senses. But if they actually want to touch the fire of life beyond matter, they have to go to the transcendental literature, the Shastra, and they have to accept it, not in a symbolical way, but they have to enter into it. Hearing from the spiritual master and serving in devotional service, then they not only will know about it, but they will enter that realm beyond matter, beyond death. Yes.
When a person is young, if he did plenty of wrongdoings, and when he comes to middle age, he started to pray to Lord Krishna, and after then he would be forgiven.
In the beginning of his life, many wrong things? Oh, yes. Krishna says, if you surrender to me, I will take away the reactions of your sinful activities. So he makes a clean slate, and then you follow nicely. In the pastimes of Lord Chaitanya, Lord Nityananda and Haridas, they went out to preach on his behalf, and they came upon the two biggest sinners of that area, of Navadvip. They were named Jaghai and Madhai. And they committed every kind of sin imaginable. They were thieves, murderers, woman hunters, drunkards. So they approached them and they tried to give them the chanting of Hare Krishna. And these drunken brothers, they even became violent toward the devotees. And anyway, finally Lord Chaitanya came. He was ready to kill them. But Lord Nityananda asked for their mercy. And so they surrendered. And although they had committed so many sins, Lord Chaitanya said, that's all right, whatever you've done is forgiven. But he said, now don't do anything, don't commit any more sins. So because they agreed, yes, we will not do any more, then they were forgiven for whatever they've done. The benedictions of bhakti yoga are very, very powerful. Doesn't matter what one has done, he can be forgiven by Krishna if he then becomes purified and follows the path. Not that he gets some benediction, purified, then again commits sinful activity, then again comes to ask forgiveness, and then again opens a new chapter of sinful activity. That's making a mockery of confessing the sin or asking for forgiveness. But Krishna can forgive you for anything if you're sincere and repentant. All right. Thank you. All glories of Prabhupada. Hare Krishna.